Baseball's all about the games, and the best in daily gaming is on the MLB app, where every day starts with new puzzles and challenges. Test your skills with MLB Pickle, the ultimate mystery player challenge, and Immaculate Grid, where stats and strategy collide, or chase the $5.6 million jackpot and beat the streak, presented by BetMGM. And for an all-new spin on fantasy sports, there's Spinball, the game's official home for games, is on the MLB app. MLB trademarks used with permission. No purchase necessary. Restrictions apply. For official rules, go to MLB.com/play/official rules.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. The
Score! This hour is brought to you by AlmostFreeTeeth.com. Save on dental implants today.
I think that group would perform significantly better than it did last year. And it's for this reason. This group will be set up to succeed in ways that last year they absolutely were not.
I do have a message here for the players. Get comfortable being uncomfortable. The bar has been set higher than it's ever been set before.
You know those voices. One of them was Ben Johnson, and the other one is who we are welcoming in studio. He normally joins us on the Circus Sports Illinois Hotline, but he is kind enough to be here today. The host of the Athletic Football Show, and I believe still a Bears fan on some level of your life, Robert Mays.
Bears. Yeah, it's a complicated relationship, but I would say yes, I definitely still am. I live and die with him more than I probably should as a 37-year-old man in my profession, but I can't really help it.
Give yourself like 10 more years, because I think you and I are similar that way. I'm a little bit older, so it'll start to step away a little bit. I'm not saying that's a good thing, like to lose your fandom, but eventually it'll just be all objective and all of that.
Yeah, I've gone back and forth about it. I think that there's part of me that wants to keep it because I think it allows me to connect with people more. Connects with fans more because you still understand what it feels like to have that like completely irrational side of you. But there's also, I don't really control it. Like the moment that the Ben Johnson news came down, my reaction to it was visceral. Like there's nothing I can do logically or removing myself from the emotion of that, even if I wanted to. So this is what we're stuck with for the next however long.
I like the idea of the shared vulnerability / insanity that comes with being a part of a fan base in general. The shared vulnerability comes through with the, when we suffer together, at least we're not suffering alone. But then also when you celebrate, you have the kinship that's there. So in both the negative and the positive. So I think you need to hold on to that for as long as possible. I understand why sometimes you're like, let me throw this in the trash or out the window. But hold on to it. Embrace it.
Definitely trash, I think. Based on his cover photo on Twitter where the Bears are going through the trash.
Yeah, that was I can't remember which offseason that was, but it was one of those offseasons where they were rummaging around in the dumpster for quarterbacks. And I was like, this is Ryan Pace and Matt Nagy. This is them, just two Bears rummaging through a garbage dump. And that's what most offseasons have felt like. Not this one, though. This one feels a little bit different. This feels like we were rummaging through recyclable items.
Ooh, okay. Those have value. Robert Mays, you can find on X. He is at Robert Mays as we broadcast live from the Score Hyundai Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers. This is Rahimi and Harris with Mark Grody on the Score. And I guess that's the beauty of being able to talk to you in studio today is since we last left you, so many different things have happened with this Bears team, whether it's trading for Jonah Jackson, Joe Tooney, whether it's adding to the line the way they did, the draft, just your impressions of it all. So I guess the first thing that comes to mind when you think of this offseason for you is what?
Aggressive. And not necessarily in a bad way. I think that they showed a lot of urgency, whether that comes with the chase for Ben Johnson, getting Ben Johnson, going out and getting Dennis Allen. I mean, these are like big swings of the sort that I've wanted them to take for a long time. I think that this organization at its most frustrating is full of half measures. And I think there weren't a lot of half measures this offseason in a way that you can appreciate. And you can extend that to the player acquisition part of it. Like doing what they did along the offensive line before free agency even started and then planting a flag with Drew Dahlman. I think that they really wanted you to know that it was going to be a little bit different this year in terms of them shoring up some of those issues they've had over the last couple seasons. And I appreciate that. You know, it comes with risk. When going out and getting a guy like Jonah Jackson, who's been hurt, you're paying a lot of money for him. The contract for Grady Jarrett, who's an aging player, is aggressive. But I think they've really kind of planted a flag, and it's a declaration of intent about what they want this season to be.
Okay, so you're talking about the intent, and I'm with you on all of that. There seems to be some holes, though, that we're still trying to plug on this roster. I'm curious as to, as you see this conversation, especially where it comes to running back, where we thought that the Bears might possibly either trade up or Ashton Jeanty at one point might fall to them, to you're taking the 22nd running back selected in the draft. What did you think about that process, and are you okay with what they have right now in the running back room?
I think so. I'm curious what the Roschon Johnson role looks like in this offense, because I think when you look at the difference between DeAndre Swift and maybe the sort of back they would chase, I think it's a little bit about consistency, making sure you have somebody that, all right, if it's blocked for five, he's getting five. They don't really have that guy if Roschon Johnson isn't that guy. But if they conceive of him being better in this offense than he was in the previous one, and they're just rolling with him, I support that. Also, there are still guys available. If they wanted to potentially sign a Nick Chubb, something like that, I don't really mind them bypassing the position in the draft, just because I think after a certain point, you're probably making a move that is sort of lateral. And I think it, as you get past the third, fourth round, those are probably the types of guys who are available. So I can understand them not feeling overly ambitious when it comes to addressing that spot.
And shouldn't at some point in time, like, we want gold at every position, but if Ben Johnson is what everybody thinks he is and he's being paid like a star coach, shouldn't we expect Ben Johnson to get more out of DeAndre Swift, to get more out of Roschon Johnson as well, especially with that interior that you mentioned at the beginning?
Yeah, and I also just think that if you're going to skimp on a certain position, running back is still probably the one that's worth skimping on. I think it's about building up the infrastructure around the running game as much as it is about finding the right running back. And you can't just ignore what they spent on DeAndre Swift last year. We can talk about whether that was smart, but you're still allocating a decent amount of resources to the position based on how the last offseason or two has gone.
And it felt like DeAndre Swift, like, people forget, and I was in on it, like, it felt like a good signing. I mean, for the most, I don't know how you felt about it.
I did not feel that way.
Okay.
I was on day one signing a guy who the Eagles decided they didn't want and had just been in that ecosystem for the entire year. That, to me, felt like something you didn't need to do on day one of free agency.
They did get Saquon, though. I mean, they went for the best of the best.
I think that the fact that DeAndre Swift had been traded, multiple teams, two teams in the last two offseasons, had decided they didn't need DeAndre Swift anymore. And you look at what he did in Philadelphia, it was fine. I think we have a lot of evidence, this year included, that the Eagles have the best rushing infrastructure in the entire NFL. So what he did there, even if it was okay, I think is a little bit of a false premise. And so that was the first move of free agency. It was truly the first thing that happened that day was the Bears signing DeAndre Swift. It's like, I'm not sure we needed to be this aggressive with this particular move.
Robert, I think your point stands specifically about it being a tell, because the Eagles offensive line is phenomenal and has been phenomenal for years on years. So to see what people said was, oh, that was good production. Good isn't good enough sometimes when you're looking at what you're working with. And so that's why I was like, I don't know that I'm on board like everybody else. I think what happens here in Chicago, and you can speak to this because you're not only just a guy who knows football, but has that connection with the Bears fandom, is understanding that just because your team made a move doesn't mean you have to agree with it or subscribe to it or be like, yeah, go team.
I don't think that's how you should approach it. I think that being a little bit skeptical and understanding that every move comes with certain downsides, certain upside, and trying to see it through that lens is important. And, you know, you should have a certain amount of expectations when it comes to how your team operates. Are they doing the right things? Are they making the right bets? And for a while, I think the answer to that was no in this town way too often. I will say that this offseason, I think the answer has been yes more often than not.
When we discussed a question that I know is in the ecosystem of the Athletic Football Show, trying to figure out whose draft it was. You know, how do we figure out Ben Johnson's thumbprint on this? We saw it in the first round pick, there's no doubt. Just played some audio from Colston Loveland this morning on with Mully and Haw talking about his injury with Michigan. We also asked the question, though, if it really was that much different from what you've seen out of a Bears draft, because I still feel like there were some reaches, there was some zigging when other teams would zag. There were still some, I think, Ryan Poles-esque picks in this thing.
Yeah, it's hard to know where to separate the responsibility for some of that stuff. I think with Ben Johnson specifically, and the first two draft picks specifically, it's kind of easy to see the imprint. Even in the process, when we were talking about Colston Loveland on our show, it was like, that just souped up Sam Laporta. Like that, like that's what he is. And so the fact that Ben Johnson liked him is not surprising. And the Luther Burden part of this, if you go back and you look at just the production the Lions offense had last year, and specifically the way they use Jameson Williams more than anything else, I think that Ben Johnson is a real believer in the way that run after catch plays into modern NFL offense. You know, he's talked so much this offseason about how passing efficiency is the biggest indicator of whether you're going to win or lose. If you look at the construction of that passing game in Detroit, they were not throwing the ball down the field. That's not how they were efficient. They were creating a lot of run after catch opportunities. And so now you bring in a guy in Luther Burden, that's what he does.
Isn't it also what DJ Moore does too, though?
It's interesting that I totally agree with that. And that was my first reaction when I saw that they drafted Luther Burden. It's just like, this feels like it's a little bit of an overlap. But my understanding after talking to people post that pick was, we want it all to feel pretty interchangeable. Like, we want guys who can play a variety of roles. And if you look at just the way the offenses are structured in the NFL now, the amount of condensed formations really kind of blurs the line between who's in the slot and who's not. And so having guys that have potentially redundant skill sets when you can move everyone around, I think that it's a little bit less of a worry because when you consider it like, all right, this is an outside guy, this is an inside guy. Then in that situation, if you have two guys that do the same thing, it's more of a problem. But if guys are a little bit more blurred and versatile within the offense, I think it becomes less of a problem. And I think that's kind of how they're conceiving of it.
So the weapons, they're there now. No one's arguing that the weapons aren't in place for Ben Johnson to do what he does as a play caller. The biggest question I have is the motor of this whole thing in Caleb Williams. And what do we expect to see out of him this season that we didn't last year? I know it's a new offense he's got to pick up. It's obviously a play caller that everyone's going to be looking at. If Caleb Williams doesn't produce like he should, or like a Ben Johnson offense has in the past 3 years or so, then people are going to be looking at him, not Ben Johnson, correct?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think because you've given him everything you can hope to give him now. The offensive line, we'll see how it all gels, but the personnel should be there to at least be a reliable unit. And you combine that with the pass catchers, and then to me, it's the relationship with the play caller and the offensive coordinator. You look at what happened last year, and it just never worked. There was never any sort of synergy between what Shane Waldron wanted to do and what Caleb Williams wanted to do. And I've come back to this a lot this offseason, but I sat down with Jared Goff last summer, and we're just going over a bunch of different stuff, but it's kind of a wide-ranging conversation about him and that offense and how it operated and why he made certain decisions. And we probably went through a dozen plays just sitting in an office in Detroit. I was like, why did you do this? And him explaining to me how his mind was working and how he understood the intention of every play to such a degree. I was like, how do you get there? Like, how do you know to get to the check down immediately like that? And to him, it was all going back to the dialogue with Ben all the time. Just like, I understand what we're trying to accomplish in any given situation because of what he's telling me. And I think that's, to me, a marker of really good offenses in the NFL. When the quarterback understands the intent of the play because the play caller and the staff have communicated that to them, you feel that way. That's what the good offenses do, and I think that's what Ben Johnson has consistently done.
What do you think Caleb Williams wants to do?
I honestly think Caleb Williams wants to play more like Jared Goff.
Really?
When you watch Caleb Williams last year, there are some moments where, you know, everyone's busy, right? The guys, it's hard to watch all 32 teams. But some people talking about Caleb Williams last year and attributing him hanging on to the ball and the high time to throw and things like that as him trying to be a creator and playoff schedule, didn't watch the Bears play. He was just standing in the pocket. He wanted to be a guy who played from the pocket. Mm-hmm. And so giving him options, break in case for emergency type stuff, giving him just everything at his disposal to play at that from that space, I think that's how he wants to play. So I don't think that there's this misalignment between how a Ben Johnson quarterback wants to play and how Caleb Williams wants to play. I think that's kind of been a misnomer as part of this process.
I think that's such a great point, because I remember him just being almost like he wouldn't get out of the pocket. And
yes,
then there would be coverage sacks where he would just get smothered and rolled over because he's like, damn it, I am standing in this pocket because this is what I want to be. I don't want everybody to think of me as Justin Fields.
I think that's right. And I think that giving him options and opportunities to just play a little bit faster, I think that's the most important thing. It's like, listen, you go 1-2 here and then you take off.
Yeah.
I don't care if you're construed as a scrambling quarterback at the end of all of this. We want to be a good offense. So I think just having him play quicker, not necessarily having him change the way he wants to play, that's the most important element of this.
This segment is brought to you by almostfreeteeth.com. Saved on dental implants today. We are talking to Robert Mays of the Athletic Football Show. And I think one of the things in your studies of the NFL that adds to this is a key that we talk about when it comes to how Ben Johnson sees Caleb Williams succeeding. And that is the EPA concept.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about that, where when Ben Johnson talks about it, what we might see on the field?
I think it's, again, run after catch opportunities are a huge part of this. Sack mitigation is a huge part of this. I think that when he's saying that stuff, what I've learned this offseason is that I don't think he's doing a lot of this by accident. I think that he's saying a lot of things that are designed to send a message. That clip you guys played before we even started here about everyone should be uncomfortable here. And after they pick Luther Burden, essentially saying, like, this is a notice to people who are in the building. Like, he's done a lot of that this offseason. And when I hear him talk about the EPA stuff, to me, that is the difference. And comparing it to turnovers, right? He's done that multiple times, where turnover differential used to be the biggest driver. Now you look at the difference in passing efficiency, that's what it actually is. I think the reason he's saying that is the Bears had an offense last year that didn't turn the ball over very often, especially throwing it, but they took an astronomical amount of sacks. The value lost on sacks in the NFL in any given year is significantly more than the value lost on interceptions. Not all interceptions are created equal. So if you're throwing 5 interceptions over the course of the year, but you're taking 55 sacks, that's not a good thing. Like, in the end, that's actually going to be worse than if you were a little bit looser with the ball over the course of a season.
And 55 would be a 13 sack improvement.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were looking at the numbers last week, Grody and I, about the sacks, and he was amazed at how few sacks that Jared Goff took, because obviously he's not a mobile quarterback, but he was getting the ball out on time. And I think that's the main thing I'm looking at, because that's why I asked that question about what Ben Johnson wants for Caleb Williams, is because I just want him to get rid of the ball. And it seems like with these weapons now in place, and you talked about the Eli Whitney interchangeable parts kind of thing, he should be able to have an idea going to the line, what exactly is going to happen, what his bailouts are. All of that should be settled. I'm just wondering how much of a learning curve there will be for that. How deep into the season will we get before he truly feels comfortable in a Ben Johnson offense?
It may be a while. You know, this isn't something that's going to happen immediately. Even guys that are really, really good offensive coordinators and good quarterbacks, it can take a little bit. My favorite example ever, because of what they did in year two, and it was historically good, is looking back at like the 2015 Falcons. Kyle Shanahan is arguably the best offensive play caller in the league. Matt Ryan is if not a Hall of Fame quarterback, then a Hall of very good quarterback who won an MVP award. In 2015, if you go back and you look at those numbers, they were average. They were like the 15th best offense in the league. Like, there's a learning curve with this stuff. And I think Ben Johnson has been good pretty much right away. Like, I actually remember the back half of that 2021 season, watching that offense in Detroit and being like, they're doing some interesting stuff here. This is actually pretty fun. Like, he was one of the guys I was really excited to talk to that next offseason when he was going into his first full season. I think he's good. I think he's proven to be good, but there's always going to be an adjustment period, especially for a young quarterback in a situation like this.
This is why 8-9, 7-10, these are the things I'm looking at, because I could see them getting off to a slow. First of all, the schedule is ridiculous, but I could also just see them getting off to a slow start and then picking up momentum on the back half, and people might be disappointed, but I'm like, it's probably going to take more than a year to compete in the way that we want the Bears to compete.
We'll see what happens. You know, there are times where that's true. There are other times where you just have sort of this transformative presence come in and everything changes. You know, going back to Jared Goff again, think about what Sean McVay was in year one when he went to LA. Mm-hmm. I mean, they went from the worst offense in the NFL in 2017, like historically bad, to a top five unit. Jaden Daniels last year. There are examples of this where it does click pretty fast. I think that it's just a wide range of outcomes here. If you told me that they were the 17th best offense in the league and that they finished 7-10, I'd be like, okay. I mean, I can understand that. I don't think that is a deal breaker if you're trying to build over multiple years. If you told me they were the 8th best offense in the league and they won 11 games, I would believe that. Like, I just think that there are a lot of different paths here that are on the table.
I love it, Robert Mays, because I said 10 last year, and I feel like that's still very much on the table.
They got halfway there, Layla.
If they have a losing season and things are going in the right direction where it feels like it's sustainable and it can go to the next level, then fine. Right? I mean, like Steve Rosenblum posed the question on one of the Saturday shows. If the Bears are 9-8 and don't make the playoffs, is that okay? I'm like, yeah, absolutely, that's okay.
Yeah, it's year one of a new coach.
Year one of a new coach. And have you seen what has been going on with the Bears? Chicago Bears have had 2 11-game losing streaks in the last 3 years, man.
I don't want to. Why'd you go to the dark place?
Sorry. Well, it's just to make a bigger point.
It's where he goes. It's just where he visits. Sometimes.
I want you to marinate on that for a second. We have to take a brief break. Robert Mays of the Athletic Football Show. You're joining us for the next
segment? Yeah, I'll be here.
Heck yes. We get another segment. And there's a lot to discuss. Major quarterback news of the NFL. We still got to figure out Aaron Rodgers.
I also want to get into the restaurant database.
We love your restaurant database work. If you haven't seen it, it is his pinned tweet on X. It is worth taking a look for yourself. All of that coming up with the great Robert Mays, Raheemy Harris, and Mark Grody on the...
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Score.
Layla Raheemy, Marshall Harris, Raheemy and Harris. Middays 10 a.m. to 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
What I'm going to be curious to see is what guys look like when the ball's not in their hands on offense, okay? Yeah, you're right. We have a lot of weapons. And so how are you going to run your route when you might not be number one in the progression, okay? How are you going to block your teammate when he has the ball? Because if you do those things right, then as a coaching staff, we're going to want to get you the ball a little bit more.
We are talking to Robert Mays of the Athletic Football Show, kind enough to join us for another segment here on Raheemy Harris and Mark Grody on The Score. And I think that's a good place to pick up where we left off, is that concept, Robert, of Ben Johnson sending messages, because I think we all heard that as well, and we saw it a little bit in how they drafted too.
Yeah, I think so many of these things, maybe I'm reading too much into it, feels like he's talking directly to DJ Moore every single time he's at the podium, which maybe is what you need. Like, I think that culture in the NFL is often set by your best players, your highest drafted players, your most impactful players. And when those guys don't play a certain way, it can bleed into everything else. And I think the Bears have made a pretty big commitment to who DJ Moore is within the context of the organization. And getting the most out of somebody like that, I think, would go a long way in making everything feel a little bit different.
I agree with you. I mean, I think of DJ a lot throughout this whole process. I want to go back really quickly back to Colston Loveland. Was it Ben, you said the souped up Matt LaPorta. Was that a Ben Johnson line?
I said that. You're before the draft. That. Yeah, the first time I watched him, it just, you watch the route running in the open field and just kind of the way that he moves and the fact that you can line him up all over the place. And he's bigger. I think that he's a little bit more explosive. Like, Sam LaPorta was the 34th pick in the draft, right? Yeah. And so you draft the guy 10th overall. You hope he's a souped up version of that guy as a prospect. And then, but I believe Ben Johnson was on the record after the draft and saying that Colston Loveland reminded him of Sam LaPorta. I think he said that to Colston Loveland.
He did, That's why I was trying not to conflate what you had said with what he had said.
This was independent. Yeah. It was the first guy that came to mind when I watched him, you know, the Fresno State game that he played and then a couple other games that he played last year. I was like, that's just Sam LaPorta with like another inch and a half and more explosiveness.
And I know things got to happen and it has to actually happen on the field. So you think the sky is the limit for this guy.
I think he has a high upside. Yeah. I think that if you look at the movement skills, again, that Fresno State game early in the season for Michigan this year, they were just using him like a wide receiver. And so you watch some of the route running ability and then the body control is extremely impressive. Like, he'll make some twisting catches up the sideline. Tight end is always a dicey proposition in the first round. I think that a little bit we're getting ahead of ourselves with him and Warren in terms of what they're going to be early because of what Brock Bowers did last year. History will tell you that first round tight ends, it's a dicey place to draft those guys. But in this draft specifically, I think you can make a solid case that he had as much upside as any player they could have taken there.
You don't want it to be Adam Shaheen. I'm sorry I did it. I brought up that name.
I'm sorry.
Hold on. I want to get back to DJ Moore because the way you mentioned him and you felt like he was talking specifically with him. I think the thing with the way I look at DJ Moore, obviously they went out, they traded for him, they gave him the extension, and he's played now 7 seasons in the NFL. He's never been on a team with a winning record. So I see him as this sort of hinge that if he's bought in, fully committed, there's no questionable plays in the middle of games where people are trying to figure out, wait, did he just quit on that play? Was he hurt? What's going on? That seems to be like one of these players. It's him, Tyreek Stevenson, where I'm going to be able to tell a lot about where this team is culture-wise by the way these guys are performing and the way they're acting as well. Is that a fair thing to say?
I absolutely think it's a fair thing to say. You know, the people have said this, and this is always what I look for too. Culture is how well your wide receivers block and how well your DBs tackle. That's what culture is. Like, if you want to feel whether a team is bought in, those are the first two things that you should look at. And I would just encourage people to go look at what DJ Moore was doing sometimes when he didn't have the ball last year, and whether or not you think the culture was healthy in Chicago.
I mean, one was blatant. I mean, where he's
there were a lot of blatant ones. The one that everyone remembers was there, but yeah. You could probably pick out 20 examples over the course of the year where something was left wanting in those moments.
And to your other point, I remember a particular there was a running play, I think, in the Southwest somewhere before like halftime where people weren't tackling. Is that
are you talking about Oscar DeMarcado running for 2,000 yards in the first half?
To give him his respect, that'd be Amari to you, by the way. Amari DeMarcado.
Amari.
Isn't it Amari? Oh, or is it Oscar?
No, okay. It's Amari. Did you say Oscar? Yeah.
Who I was? I was in baseball brain. I think I was in baseball.
That's okay. Right? I just like it.
Thank you.
Oscar was like traumatic to me.
Oscar
Mercado.
Yeah.
I remember tweeting after that game, after the Cardinals game, that it was the low point of the Eberflus era. And then the New England game happened the week after.
That's crazy, right?
Yeah. At home. Yeah.
Because you were thinking, okay, they're going back home. They're going to get it together and at least put up a fight at home. When I say they rolled over and died at home, it was amazing because I was like, I didn't think that was possible in that manner.
They were the worst team in the NFL at that point, the Patriots, weren't they?
They had like 30
sacks on
Robert
the year.
Mays.
They had 9 of them in that game.
Unbelievable.
It's brutal. I mean, and I honestly appreciated that day because sometimes you hem and you haw about what teams should do, right? It's like, oh, should they move on from this guy? Should they not? And then that game happens. It's like, well, he's getting fired tomorrow. Like, there's nothing else you can do. Like, that coaching staff can't come back
but he didn't
and coach
the
offense again. The offensive coordinator did.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, the Bears did business. I got no criticism. They fired a head coach for the first time in their history, and they got rid of the offensive coordinator. So
I also think it's worth asking, Robert, because you're so tapped in into the rest of the league, what the viewpoint was at that time of the failure that was going on here.
I think that there was a concern heading into the season. It was the concern that I had in that bringing Eberflus back and going out and getting a guy like Shane Waldron, you're shooting to be like the 15th best offense in the NFL. And I just don't think that's what you should be shooting for. It was my problem with their process in the moment. I think you don't move on from coaches when you think that you're headed in the right direction and you think that it would be more disruptive to move on than it would be to keep somebody. And I just don't think that was the case when you're drafting a quarterback number one overall. Like, the defense making strides in the back half of the 2023 season is not a good enough reason to bring back a defensive-minded head coach who has shown an inability to find the right play caller with a guy that you've been maneuvering to get with a number one overall pick for 2 years. So they've hopefully kind of made up for that sin in the way that they've handled this offseason, but there was really no reason that Ben Johnson couldn't have been here the year before. Like, that was an option, and I think it's one they probably should have explored, and I think other people did too.
I'm sorry, I was distracted because I was looking at the restaurant database because I'm getting ready to go into that portion. I want y'all to exhaust some of the football stuff before I turn the page, though.
Okay, I'll start. The retirement of Derek Carr, and I said to you during the break, I feel like both Carr brothers have had unsatisfying career arcs when it came to quarterbacking in the NFL.
I think for David Carr, that's absolutely the case. When you're the number one pick, and obviously, I remember that. You remember that ESPN, it was an ESPN commercial for the NFL draft. I think it was in either 2004, 2005. And they had photoshopped out his offensive line. And it was the tagline was like, what does your team need this offseason? And it was based on David Carr's rookie season. So I think that was always kind of doomed from the start, just based on what the Texans were working with early on. With Derek Carr, I think it's more complicated than that. Like, Derek Carr, we were talking about it during the break. He's 22nd all time in passing yards. He had 11 seasons. He's made $200 million playing football. As a second round pick, if you look at the history of second round quarterbacks, it's not very good. Like, it's hard to find quarterbacks in that range of the draft. So I think in some ways, Derek Carr was better than what his draft slot would dictate. But I think in others, and the two teams I would go back to, I actually really enjoyed the 2020 and 2021 Raiders teams with John Gruden as the coach. They slung the ball around. It was an aggressive offense. It was very fun. And I think part of my experience and just the way I look at Derek Carr is, why couldn't have it all been like that? Like, why couldn't have he been in these situations where he was pushing the ball down the field a little bit more? He's kind of this paradox of a player where he's got a ton of arm. He can really, really push the ball downfield, but the uneasiness and the skittishness in the pocket and his unwillingness to kind of stand in and do that kind of stuff, I think probably took away from what he could have actually been.
I think the thing with David Carr that amazed me was he just had no chance early on. He has two of the top three most sack seasons, including 76 times his rookie year. 76 times in a 16-game season.
You think it didn't come to mind when we were watching last season?
Yeah. Yeah, because Caleb Williams tied his other mark of 68, that, you know, that number that hangs over us. And I will be happy if Caleb Williams just takes less than 40 sacks this year.
That would be a huge step in the right direction.
That would be remarkable. And then the other quarterback question I have is not about the Giants room, which I think somebody should do a show on. But it's what do you think happens to Aaron Rodgers?
I think he probably ends up in Pittsburgh. I just don't know what their other options are at this point other than trading for Kirk Cousins. And at this point, I think them, all things being equal, being able to just sign Aaron Rodgers outright versus having to give up something in next year's draft for Cousins when you want to maintain as much ammo as you possibly can because of what you're probably going to have to do to find a quarterback, I can understand why they think Rodgers is the more attractive option.
Any chance you think he'll just walk away?
Sure.
Yeah. Like I'm leaning more and more towards retirement every day.
And if that's the case, then I think the Cousins is the thing they have to do because I feel like they have to try to salvage the season in some way if they can. And he is still available.
We're talking football with Robert Mays of the Athletic Football Show here and Raheemy Harris and Mark Grody on the score. And Grotz, I know you've got a thought.
Well, I just have one question. And I know I'm going to say the name of this person and everybody's going to go crazy, but I'll just ask it. Do you think Bill Belichick will ever coach in the NFL again?
No.
No, he's done.
I don't think so. I mean, I feel like the league kind of told them what they thought of him this offseason. Mm-hmm. And it's not surprising to me. And it's not surprising to me on a few different levels. I just think that the way modern NFL coaches work, it's really, really hard to consolidate that level of power throughout the entire organization. And it's really hard to consolidate that level of power throughout the entire organization when you've been bad at a lot of the stuff. Right? If player acquisition's been bad, it's staffing has been bad. I just don't think people want to make that bargain with Bill Belichick at this point in his career. Like the idea that you would hire Bill Belichick and then Matt Patricia and Josh McDaniels and the entire band would be coming with him, it's not something I would want to sign up for right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking at the Maze restaurant list.
There we go.
Just pinned to the top of your Twitter profile. There are 103 restaurants that are listed.
Updates coming this week.
Updates
really?
Are coming this week? Okay.
Updates coming
okay.
this week.
Is it the Beast? Oh, wait. Yeah, that's another
this
thing.
Is the
yeah.
Beast of yeah. Chicago restaurants.
So what I want to know is, of these restaurants, if I just had to go... I have somebody in town, and I just have to try one of these restaurants.
This is way too simple of a question. I need like 10 more details before
okay,
I give you
I'll
an
give
answer.
You I'll give you details. I'll give you details. Let's scratch some cuisines off.
Okay.
Okay, so we're going to say no sushi.
Okay.
Aww. We're
I knew that was going to be your response. We're also going to say, let's say no Chinese. No, yeah, actually, we'll just narrow it down to one genre. Italian. Give me your top Italian restaurant in the city of Chicago.
I mean, it's not that creative to say, but I think Monteverde is still probably the place I would go for Italian.
I've been there,
and that's the problem is with that, you have to get so far ahead of it when it comes to reservations that it can be a little bit tough. Other than that, like I like Daisy's still. Daisy's is a local neighborhood restaurant for me. I live in Logan Square, and so I've been there a million different times. I think that's a good pasta place. I'm trying to think of other good Italian. We don't go out for Italian that much, if I'm being honest. If you look at that list, there is not a ton of Italian places on there.
Is there one that would go, because you don't really have any, I'm from the South, you don't really have any like super comfort food on here. So what is the most comfort foodish that you would go off your list?
Like fried chicken?
That could qualify, yeah.
Just like, well, Southern food in general, like if you want to go down and get, I mean, Virtue to me is like one of the best dinners in the entire city down
and there
in
too.
Park.
Okay, I feel like I'm doing well with this list.
Virtue's really, really good. There are a lot of places I haven't been that I want to go. Like I actually haven't been to Big Jones. I haven't been to Luella's Southern Kitchen. I haven't been down to Rue.
Big Jones is great.
So all of those places are spots I actually want to hit. Comfort food, other than that, like I'm trying to conceive of like what I would think of as comfort food.
Well, I like good dumplings. What's the best dumplings?
QXY is where I would go for dumplings.
Okay.
Down in Chinatown.
All right.
They've got a ton of really, really good ones. That's probably the place I would recommend the most for that.
I like the organization and also the versatility of this list.
There's a lot of different ways you can go with it. There's a ton of different ways that you can go with it. It's I try to have something for everybody depending on like what the the occasion is, right? Like if you want to go big, there's some big spots on there. If you want to have a really, really casual place or like, you know, tacos, there's a lot of taco places on there. So I was getting so many questions from people.
I like tacos.
There's a lot of good tacos in Chicago. There's a lot of good Mexican food in Chicago. I was getting a lot of messages from people. They'd be like, where should I go eat?
And I was that's just too vague.
And I was like, well, here's 150 places. Like, let me know where you end up.
What's the maze? Do you have a top five? Can you narrow it down to five?
Ooh, the places
say
that
five,
I
five and then there's seven, I'm not going to be mad.
So in terms of like my favorite, if I had an unlimited budget where I would go eat in Chicago, Oriole is still like my favorite like occasion type of place. I've been to most of the big ones here and that is still like the most memorable meal I've had in Chicago in a long time. When I have people come from out of town, like brunch at Lula Cafe is like a pretty standard thing, especially as you get into the summer. The Logan Square Farmers Market is right outside, so there's no reservations. So you go put your name in, and then you can just walk the farmers market for an hour, go pop in for brunch. They have a standard brunch menu, but then they have specials every day, and so every week. And so we just get everything on the specials menu. And so it's a different meal every time we go.
I like that.
I had people in town for work a couple weeks ago for the draft, and if you need something that you can get a reservation, it's classic, it's reliable. Avec is still awesome. Like it's been there for 25 years. It is so, so, so good. Boca is really underrated in terms of like, I think the Michelin star places, like we went there for the first time last year for my wife's birthday and really enjoyed it. Elska is great. And then in my neighborhood, Giant and Mito Kai are like two of my favorites. I absolutely love Giant. That's Giant the closest restaurant to my house.
Giant is outstanding.
So yeah, it's hard to list off a bunch of them, but Hai Su Vietnamese is fantastic. It's down in Pilsen. Marisco San Pedro, which is like a Marisco's place. It's just all Mexican seafood is down there in Pilsen now. It's in the old Talia Hall, or it's in the old Dusex space in yes. Talia Hall.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, you could never get to all the places you wanted to get to, I guess is what I would say.
I got to get to work. Robert Mays, thank you so much for not only your football thoughts, but your Chicago restaurant thoughts as well. Anything else you need to keep the people noted of before you get out of here?
The Athletic Football Show. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. We do it more often than we should in the offseason, so it's available to you.
You absolutely do. We'll look forward to the spreadsheet, the Google Doc update later today.
Oh, it's going to take me like a week to do it, okay. But it'll be coming at some point. I try to do it at the end of every year. And then at the end of last year, we had to cancel a bunch of reservations. And so I was like, you know what? I'll just revisit this. But that list will be 150 wow. By the time it's done.
Well, fabulous stuff all the way around. Robert, thank you for the time and for coming in.
Happy to be here.
Coming up next, it is halftime on Raheemy Harris and Mark Grody on the Score. Unfortunately, a masterpiece has been damaged.
Wow, that sounds ominous. Also, name that kid. I'll be talking about what the top names are now this time around.
I have an epic anniversary or an anniversary of an epic home run in this town.
Oh, yeah, you do. That's next.
Baseball's all about the games, and the best in daily gaming is on the MLB app, where every day starts with new puzzles and challenges. Test your skills with MLB Pickle, the ultimate mystery player challenge, and Immaculate Grid, where stats and strategy collide, or chase the $5.6 million jackpot and beat the streak, presented by BetMGM. And for an all-new spin on fantasy sports, there's Spinball. The game's official home for games is on the MLB app. MLB trademarks used with permission. No purchase necessary. Restrictions apply. For official rules, go to MLB.com/play/official rules.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Next.
What time is it?
It's halftime.
It is indeed halftime on Raheemy and Harris with Mark Grody. We started talking about the Cubs and Mets series. We got some breaking news about Michael Jordan. Yes, NBA on NBC has hired him to be a special contributor. So we're trying to figure out what that means, but the more MJ in the league, the better, that is for sure. At 10:45, we talked about Colston Loveland and his injury, and then Robert Mays of the Athletic Football Show just joined us for two segments.
It's halftime.
Who wants to get us started here? I'm looking in your direction, Marshall.
Mine's quick. I just wanted to update you guys about the most common baby names in America. This is something the Social Security Administration has been tracking going back to 1880.
1880?
Yeah, this year's winners.
How do they know all the babies then?
Five-time defending champion now, Liam, on the boys' side. Meanwhile, Olivia unseats Emma as the top name for the past 3 years after Emma had a nice three-peat. But, you know, everything must come to an end. The top names for boys in respective order, Noah, Oliver, Elijah, James, William, Benjamin, Lucas, Henry, and Theodore. And then for girls, Olivia, Emma, Charlotte, Amelia, Ava, Sophia, Isabella, Mia, Evelyn, and Harper. What I found interesting, the one that made the biggest rise for girls is the name Raya. Do you think people are naming their kid after a successful match on the dating app, Raya?
I hope not. That would be way too cliche. Why don't you just name your child Tinder while you're at it?
Wow. Okay. See, what up, I told you mine was quick. Go ahead.
Layla?
Speaking of children, when you were a wee child and you're with your parents and say you were in like the China section at the department
don't
store.
Don't touch
or
anything.
The TV section. What was the number one rule?
Don't touch
no
anything.
Touchy.
My dad called it the danger zone. That's how much he had us scared. He was like, danger zone. Why are we here?
He doesn't want to pay for anything that you're going to break.
So imagine the horror of a parent in the Netherlands when a child destroyed, well, not destroyed, but they damaged a $50 million Mark Rothko painting.
How?
Exactly. Now, the good news is it wasn't destroyed. The damage is superficial, but then the next quote is this. Small scratches are visible in the unvarnished paint layer in the lower part of the painting. Oh. Scratches on a Mark Rothko.
But it's still one of a kind, right?
Well, yes, but so, now it's damaged.
Authentically
what
damaged.
What are you talking
about? Authentically
damaged.
I think that makes it, gives a little charm.
Like 100 years from now, like there was a little child that scratched the hell out of this
painting.
Yeah. That child is not Mark Rothko. So here's the worst part is that the Rothko painting was hanging in the museum's depot, which is a publicly accessible storage facility beside the main museum, because it's part of an exhibition that was displaying a selection of public favorites. So they wanted to make them more accessible so everybody could look and enjoy.
Too accessible.
This kiddo didn't understand the danger zone command and was like, let me scratch.
This is why we can't have nice things.
It's like you brought Dave the cat to check out a Mark Rothko.
He's just a baby, though,
and he's
Dave.
Like, I'm going to make biscuits on this Mark Rothko $50 million painting. What would you do?
Oh, man. Oh, if Dave was going to do that?
Yeah.
Oh, I would let him do it because he's just a baby. He doesn't understand.
Wow.
Is that why he's,
that's how you parent?
He's running the hallways?
That's why I don't have children.
How's your neighbor's welcome mat,
Brody? Don't worry about the welcome mat. We're doing well. I have a video of that I'm going to have to send you. Dave. Yeah.
That's crazy.
You're going to have to send us, Twitch is also very interested in Dave the cat activities.
Okay. I'll get some Dave video soon.
We love Friday Dave, too. Friday. You just Friday. Abandoned that on your Instagram.
You're right. It's time to bring back Friday. I will bring back Friday. You guys ready for this?
Yes.
25 years ago yesterday, in the year 2000.
In the year 2000.
Thank you. Glenn Allen Hill did this at Wrigley Field.
You like the red shoes or the blue shoes better?
Like that. I like the blue shoes better. Way out of here. Oh, my gosh. Across the street. I have never seen that. On top of the building. Even he admired that shot. On top of the roof.
490 feet is the estimation on that home run. It's got to be longer than that.
That was an epic home run by Glenn Allen Hill, as called by Chip Carey. Bob Brenly on the call as well. That was an amazing moment in Cubs Wrigley Field history. The great Glenn Allen Hill.
Was that wind aided or was it aided by something else?
That's good. Many a people wonder. I mean, there's been other, like Dave Kingman hit a 530-footer in 1979 at the third house porch across Waveland Avenue. Schwarber planted that one on the top of the right field scoreboard in 2015. Chris Bryant, I saw him hit a 455-footer. But there was just something epic about landing the baseball in the rooftop when there weren't a million rooftops out there.
No, that was, it looks surreal.
It looks surreal. That's a great way to describe it.
Looks like something out of the movies.
Yes.
It looks like something that isn't humanly possible.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you know, like I said, wind aided or otherwise aided.
Well, I mean, Pixar didn't happen, but it did.
There was a swirl.
There was video.
Yeah. Indeed. We have more to come here on Rahimi and Harris with Mark Grody. It is time for Five on It, our five top questions of our day. Not the day, but our day. It's a fun segment. Join us next.
Baseball's all about the games. And the best in daily gaming is on the MLB app, where every day starts with new puzzles and challenges. Test your skills with MLB Pickle, the ultimate mystery player challenge, and Immaculate Grid, where stats and strategy collide. Or chase the $5.6 million jackpot and beat the streak, presented by BetMGM. And for an all-new spin on fantasy sports, there's Spinball, the game's official home for games, is on the MLB app. MLB trademarks used with permission. No purchase necessary. Restrictions apply. For official rules, go to MLB.com/play/official rules.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.